Remind me again why we're in an old, rundown cemetery before midnight on Halloween Eve?
You saw the invitation. I figured if we didn't come, those two might kill us. Or worse.
Can't believe Tala and Kane are actually getting married.
I can't believe who's here. Is that Swamp Thing?
Ooh, Etrigan. He doesn't look as cuddly as I thought he would.
At least they have a decent spread of food.
The buffet table is crawling away.
We'll get drive-thru.
Greetings, travelers. Know now that the next choice you make may change your life for all eternity and tip the balance between order and chaos. Follow me, for I am the Phantom Stranger. Friend of the bride or the groom?
We don't like either one of them, so whichever.
So Abel is Kane's best man, and Madame Xanadu is Tala's bridesmaid?
Yes, and you can stop staring at her now.
Hey, I read that one Spectre comic as a teen, so sue me.
Up there at the podium, the guy officiating, is that DJ Fear or whoever?
PJ Frightful. And yes, that's definitely him. Hey, PJ, I didn't know you could perform a wedding.
I got certified online. Now I DJ and perform horror-themed weddings. I'm also available for horror-themed bar mitzvahs, horror-themed quinceañeras, and horror-themed tax filings. Here's my card.
Ooh, we got here just in time. The ceremony is starting.
I see Clarion, the witch boy, is the ring bearer.
And the rings still have fingers in them. Ugh.
Is that Felix Faust walking her down the aisle? I guess he doesn't hold a grudge.
Dearly departed, we are gathered here tonight to witness the joining of this ghoul with this sorceress in unholy matrimony. Kane, do you take this barefoot temptress to be your lawfully wedded wife? Do you promise not to hatchet her to death? At least not until after the honeymoon.
Of course.
Tala, do you take this Len Wein lookalike to be your husband? Do you promise to listen to his endless stories and not rip out his tongue?
Yes, darling.
If anyone should object to this terrifying union, speak now or forever hold.
Solomon Grundy objects!
Oh, here we go.
I also object. She'll marry that cad over my transparent body. Who didn't see this coming?
You two, pipe down. I want that house. I love this man.
I object as well.
Oh, no.
You, brother, how dare you? I object because Tala and I have been having a passionate affair. She's carrying my love child. You, I'll kill you both for this. You'll kill me anyway.
Well, at least it wasn't dull.
Just another Halloween season at the House of Frankenstein. Grundy love a happy ending.
There's a creepy old house out in the hills, a domicile of weirdness, horror, and thrills, where you never have to wait in line. It's the House of Frankenstein, a strange couple there. Are your hosts? They talk of comics and movies with monsters and ghosts. A peculiar place where the sun doesn't shine. It's the House of Frankenstein.
Hello and welcome to episode 116 of Supermates, the husband and wife geekcast. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Chris, and welcome to our final trip to the House of Frankenstein in 2025. We're shutting down this season with a bang. We're covering the most recent film we've ever covered here on House of Frankenstein, but it's an instant classic and Cindy's pick.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we're covering one of the best films of 2025 that also just happens to be a great horror film, Ryan Coogler's Sinners.
We normally don't bother with spoiler warnings here because some of the films we cover are nearly 100 years old. But this time, we want to say up front, if you haven't seen Sinners, and we recommend that you really watch this film, But watch it first, then listen to this episode, because we're going to spoil it for sure.
Oh, we're going to spoil the crap out of it.
Oh, definitely. Sinners was released April 18th, 2025. Written and directed by Ryan Coogler. In the cast, we had Michael B. Jordan as Smoke and Stack, Miles Caton as Sammy Moore, Saul Williams as Jedediah, Jack O'Connell as Remick, Dave Maldonado as Hogwood, Helen Yu as Lisa Chow, Yao as Bo Chow, Lee June Lee as Grace Chow, Delroy Lindo as Delta Slim, Jamie Lawson as Pearline, Haley Steinfeld as Mary, Omar Miller as Cornbread, Wunmi Masako as Annie, Peter Germanis as Bert, Lola Kirk as Joan, and Buddy Guy as Old Sammy.
I've been all over this world. I seen men die in ways I ain't even know was possible. Love you, brother. Be careful. I will. With all the things that I seen, I ain't ever seen no demons, no ghosts, no magic. Till now.
Hey, get back inside.
Let me in, man! Some weird shit going on out here.
You keep dancing with the devil.
You gotta let me in. Smoke, you gotta let me in.
One day he's gonna follow you home.
The movie opens on October 15, 1932 in Clarksdale, Mississippi. Sammy, preacher boy Moore, retrieves his guitar from the church of his father, Jedediah, pastor of the local church. Jedediah doesn't approve of Sammy playing secular music, but Sammy promises to be back in time for services the next morning. Jedediah is even more distressed when Sammy gets a ride from his nephews, Elijah Smoke and Elias Stack Moore, the Smokestack twins. They've returned to their hometown after 7 years in Chicago working for Al Capone. Earlier that morning, they bought an old sawmill from a white local named Hogwood and plan to fulfill their dream of opening their own juke joint.
Sammy and Stack go to the train station to retrieve blues player Delta Slim, but Stack runs into his old flame Mary, a white woman who Stack abruptly left years ago. The two have an argument before Stack announces the grand opening of Club Juke that night. Sammy makes the acquaintance of a singer named Pearline. The two flirt, despite her mentioning a husband. Stack, Sammy, and Slim pick up a large friend named Cornbread from the cotton fields to act as bouncer at the club. Smoke goes into town and pays a visit to his friends and local store owners, Bo and Grace Chow, ordering food and other supplies for the opening night. He stops by the shack of his lover, Annie, and visits the grave of their infant daughter. Smoke argues that Annie's hoodoo practicing never did her any good, but she reminds him of the bag she gave him that has kept him and Stack alive through wars and other conflicts over the years. The two reconcile, make love, and head for the sawmill.
Meanwhile, an Irishman named Remick appears at the door of Ku Klux Klan member Bert and his wife Joan, claiming he is being chased by Choctaw Indians. The Choctaw arrive and Joan meets them at the door with a rifle. The Choctaw leader warns her Remick isn't what he seems, but she denies harboring him. When she leaves, she finds Remick covered in blood and Bert dead on the floor. He rises, and Remick tells her he's all better now.
Club Juke has a huge turnout, but Smoke is upset with Stack and Annie for taking in wooden nickels and other credits used at the plantation. Mary arrives, and despite some wanting her to leave, she stays and has a heart-to-heart with Stack. He tells her he still loves her, but sent her away to marry a white man to keep her safe from the danger he attracts. Sammy plays a new song he's written that literally brings the house down. It pierces the veil between the past and the future. Funk guitarists and hip-hop artists appear besides tribal dancers. This catches the attention of Remick, Bert, and Joan, who arrive to join the party and spend money, offering to play their Irish folk music. They ask to enter, but not wanting problems with the whites, Smoke sends them away, sensing something odd about them.
Sammy hooks up with Pearline while Stack tells Mary about how they won't break even. She volunteers to talk to Remick's group, who are still waiting outside. After playing a tune, Remick proves he does indeed have money. Gold coins from long ago. In conversation, Mary mentions the recent passing of her mother. Remick regrets not meeting her sooner so he could save her. Mary is disturbed by their behavior, pulls a gun on them, and walks away. Remick rises from the ground behind her. Inside, Sammy tells Smoke he's going to leave Clarksdale and head to Chicago to play his music. Smoke, wanting him to stay safe playing church music, strongly discourages this, pulling a gun on him. Sammy stands his ground.
Mary returns and asks a puzzled Cornbread if she can come inside. He then has Slim take over at the door while he goes outside to pee, but something whispers to him from the bushes. Mary shows the coins to Stack, and she aggressively starts to make love to him. Smoke breaks up a fight between patrons and asks Sammy to fetch Stack. When they find him, he's bleeding out from a neck wound inflicted by Mary, who is covered in blood. Smoke shoots her repeatedly, but she rises and threatens by saying,
"We gonna kill every last one of you,"
and runs out of the building. Stack dies in a devastated Smoke's arms. Annie believes Mary is possessed by a haint. Slim sends the patrons home, and Bo-Chow goes outside to start their car. Cornbread shows up at the door, asking to come back in. Annie points out he never needed an invitation before. Smoke reluctantly agrees to give him his money, and he tries to bite his arm. Smoke shoots him square in the face, but Cornbread gets up, and they bar the door.
Stack rises behind the door they locked his body in. After trying to persuade them to let him out, he knocks the door down. Annie splashes him with pickled garlic, which causes his skin to smoke, and he runs out the door. Annie declares they are dealing with vampires. She gives them a course on Vampire 101 and how to destroy them. There's no way to cure them. They can only be free from the curse and set their souls free. After preparing weapons, Annie makes Smoke promise he'll kill her if she's bitten. Smoke and Sammy see Remick leading the vampires, including Stack, Mary, and Cornbread, in an Irish chant and dance. Later at the door, he tries to get the survivors to join them, offering fellowship in a world that has denied them every opportunity. He tells them that they're all connected. So through Bo, he knows about Grace's daughter Lisa and threatens her. He sees Sammy and tells him he's the reason he came. He's unable to move on and see his ancestors, but Sammy's gift can connect them. If they hand over Sammy, he will let the rest live. They, of course, refuse. Remick and Stack tell them how Hogwood, who is the grand dragon of the clan, sold them the property just to set them up for a slaughter. Mary tells them they can't let them go free because they're family, and they want them to join them in heaven on earth. Stack tries to appeal to Smoke, but the rest shut the door.
Grace, fearing for her daughter, invites them in so she can destroy them. The vampires enter and attack. Grace impales her husband, but both are consumed by fire. Annie realizes that the others feel pain when Remick is hurt, but she is bitten by Stack and pleads with Smoke to keep his promise, which he reluctantly does. Slim sacrifices himself, cutting his arm to distract most of the vampires while the rest flee upstairs. Remick attacks Sammy and Pearline is bitten, defending him. Sammy makes it outside, but Remick follows. Stack attacks Smoke, but Annie's hoodoo bag protects him. Outside, Remick has Sammy, who hits him with his guitar, the silver resonator inlay causing him pain. But he is going in for the kill when Smoke impales him. As the sun rises, Remick and the horde of vampires burst into flames.
Smoke sends Sammy home with their car. He unloads a trunk full of weapons from their truck. When Hogwood and the clansmen arrive to slaughter their prey, Smoke lays in wait and unleashes an arsenal, killing them all. Shot himself and dying, Smoke sees Annie and their daughter. Sammy, scarred from his fight with Remick and covered in blood, holding on to the neck of his destroyed guitar, arrives at his father's church as promised. The congregation is stunned, but Jedediah calls his son to him and tells him to denounce his sinful ways. Sammy leaves in the car with what's left of his guitar beside him. 60 years later, an elderly Sammy plays the blues at his club named Pearline's. He's visited by two familiar, youthful faces, Stack and Mary. Smoke let him go as long as he promised to leave Sammy alone. They all agree, despite what happened. Before the sunset, that day was the best of their lives.
Okay. That was a hard movie to synopsize, by the way.
Yes, I'm sure.
There's a lot to this movie. A lot more than your average Hammer film. So, we have to set the stage for how we saw this movie. Because I convinced you and Danny to see Robert Eggers' remake of Nosferatu on New Year's Day because we had nothing else to do. And that went over like a lead balloon.
I know some people out there like it. No, thank you.
Yeah, I gotta say, I didn't. I appreciate the artistry of the film. I can't say I actually enjoyed it. And I really have some problems with some of the things he did and the message that it sends.
Mm-hmm.
Like you pointed out, there's a very nasty kind of message about victim blaming.
Yep.
In that film, that's kind of troublesome and kind of surprising that they didn't see that when they made it.
I know.
It's like, but yeah. So no, that did not go over well. So we saw a poster for Sinners somewhere. Then I saw the first trailer, and I think by that point it was already out and had done really well that first weekend and had great word of mouth. But, you know, I said, well, we could go see it when we take Danny back to her school, and your guys are like, you're not taking us to another vampire
movie.
Yeah,
we're like, I don't know about letting you choose anymore.
I'm like, it's got Michael B. Jordan and Hailee Steinfeld and all these, you know,
yeah,
all these people we like. So I finally convinced you, but it took a while.
Mm-hmm.
It took a little convincing, but I think I redeemed myself.
You did.
We all really liked it. I unfortunately saw the second trailer, which stupidly reveals that Stack has turned into a vampire. But I didn't let you guys didn't see that.
No.
I did before we went, and I'm like, why would they do that?
Yeah.
Who decided? I mean, they already show that Hailee Steinfeld is
right
in the first one. You know, I mean, but that's one of the visuals is her covered in blood, and we're going to kill every last one of it, you know, I mean.
Yeah.
But, I mean, so, but yeah, I think I redeemed myself from the first vampire movie of the year that did not, none of us really like that well. Yeah,
no.
So, again, and the reason I wanted to see that so bad is I so love the story of Dracula.
I know.
It's one of my favorite books. I love it, and I love it when I feel like a film's going to adapt it. You know, pretty
faithfully. Yeah.
And I felt like this one kind of kind of did for the most part, but you know, added like, you know, necrophilia and all sorts of other gross shit.
Well, let's worry about this movie
yeah,
instead of that one.
I know, but anyway. So at the beginning, we get Annie explaining that in different cultures, there were tales of those whose music could pierce the veil between life and death, past and future. The Irish called them Philly, the Choctaw called them Fire Keepers, and in West Africa, Griots. She says it can heal communities but also attracts evil. I really like the changing music in the illustrations that they use.
Oh, definitely.
It really sets the mood. And it's interesting that, of course, that you've got the Irish, the Choctaw, and the Africans,
mm-hmm,
that, you know, all those people are represented in this film. You know, not as much of the Choctaw, but we'll get into that. But so we begin at the end of the movie.
Yes.
Which I didn't really cover in the synopsis. Sammy shows up at his father's church with bloody guitar in hand on October 16th, 1932. So most of the events happened between the 15th and the 16th.
Yes.
So right around the time that we're recording this.
That's what I was getting ready to say.
Right,
yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, you guys are going to hear it right before Halloween, but this is like literally right around the time we're recording it. We do see a flash of Remick and other events throughout that night as Sammy's reliving the night. Coogler has said From Dusk Till Dawn was an influence, but he wasn't hiding the fact that this story involved vampires for some dramatic reveal later, like that movie did.
Right.
Like that movie is a crime thriller until they go into the club and
Yes. They
all become turned into vampires, which that's a great movie too.
Yes.
We ought to do that one of these days.
Yes, we should. We should.
I watched that again a few years ago for the first time, and I really enjoyed that movie. We see Sammy's usual day, but he's packing it all in early. He picks his quota in the cotton field, stops by and kisses his mom, wakes up his many siblings, and looks for his guitar under his bed, which is not there. And Coogler does a great job of establishing the lives these characters are never going to make it back to.
Yeah.
I mean, we see how these people live day to day, and this is like, they have no idea that it's never going to be normal again, and most of them ain't going to be alive by the next morning.
I know.
So, this is Miles Caton's first movie and first acting credit. He learned to play the guitar for this movie.
My goodness.
I assumed he was already a blues guitarist of some note, but apparently not.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that according to IMDb, unless it's wrong, which, you know, sometimes they're wrong, but usually on a new movie like this, they're not. But, yeah, it's insane. And he's so good in this. I mean, he's got such a voice, and he's convincingly plays this character that's this, you know, phenom of a singer and a guitarist. It's like, wow, yeah. Also, it's amazing that they pulled off Michael B. Jordan playing two roles here. I mean, it's flawless.
Yes.
I never saw it anything that looks like, oh, his head's kind of floating or...
No.
And if it hadn't worked, it would have sunk this entire movie.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, he worked with Coogler on all Coogler's films, starting with Fruitvale Station, and including Creed and Black Panther, so they obviously like working together, but this is like next level.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah. Even though Jordan is a big star and I know him well, I still within this film forget that Stack and Smoke are being played by the same actor.
Me too.
I mean, I totally buy it. It's a credit to Jordan and Coogler and everyone involved for making this work. Percy Bell was the primary body double and also played one of the chain gang that Slim shouts out to later. So he's actually in the film as himself briefly too. So just showing them handing off the cigarette back and forth proves this is going to work.
Yeah.
Also note, Stack always rolls smoked cigarettes. When he's not with him and Annie's later, he smokes a pipe and he can't roll one at the end.
Huh.
So he can't roll his own cigarettes. And it's oddly enough, he smoke in Stack.
Oh. Huh.
The Smokestack Twins are named after Smokestack Lightning, a blues song by Howlin' Wolf. So,
okay.
Of course, everyone knows Jordan played Eric Killmonger in Black Panther and Wakanda Forever and voiced him in the What If series. Most also know he played Johnny Storm in that ill-fated Fantastic Four, Fanforstic reboot in 2015. You know, that Fantastic Four movie. But even I didn't know that he voiced Cyborg in the animated movie Justice League, The Flashpoint Paradox.
Oh, there you go.
I had no idea. That's after I'd pretty much dropped out of those films. So, something I noticed in the theater during these opening scenes, like up to when we get to Club Juke, there are buzzards or hawks, some kind of bird of prey or some kind of, you know, bird that eats carcasses circling in the sky.
Huh.
There's one when the twins meet Hogwood, and we'll see more of them later.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting. It's kind of like, and the number kind of indicates, I guess the number kind of indicates the evil people, because there's one when Hogwood comes up.
Okay.
So, yeah. Their meeting is a bit tense. They ask what was on the floors. Do you think they'd killed black people in there before?
I don't know. It makes you wonder.
Yeah. It makes me wonder, yeah. Because when they say that about later, it's a killing floor.
Yeah.
So it makes me wonder if they hadn't slaughtered them in there before.
Yeah.
Mm. When he calls them boys.
Mm-hmm.
And he is stupid enough to show he's armed too, even though he's surrounded. But whoever said racists were smart.
Exactly.
They hand him a satchel of money, and Smoke tells him he doesn't want to see him or his clan buddies on their property. So do you think he knew Hogwood had been in the clan or just recognized the type?
I mean, almost you got to figure most people there probably were in the Klan. Most white men.
Yeah, especially if they had any money.
Yep.
Yeah. Sammy has his confrontation with his father. I like they didn't make his dad a hypocrite. He doesn't lay a hand on him, and he is literally practicing what he preaches. He doesn't approve of him using his gift for drunkards and philanderers. And prophetically, he says, if he keeps dancing with the devil, someday he's going to follow him home.
Yep.
So, I mean, they could have made him a real jerk, but I mean, yes, he's very religious, but he really is like, you know, he's fearful that his son's going to get in over his head with bad people and get hurt. But Sammy proves he knows the Bible backwards and forwards by quoting scripture without even looking at the book. He just wants to have some fun and play his music. And, you know, I can see both sides as a parent, you know, let the kid live a little, but also, if he goes down that path,
Yeah, give him boundaries.
Yeah.
He's also a grown man.
He's also a grown man by this point, yeah. Saul Williams, that plays Jedediah, is a famous slam poet, and he's been in several films, including K-Pax and Blink Twice. So, it's kind of funny that he's like he's a slam poet, but he's like, he uses that skill as like to put across that Southern preacher type, yeah. He's none too happy to see him get a ride with the twins. Stack says, "Don't you worry, Uncle Jed, we'll get him back in one piece." Barely, but they do.
Yeah.
But just barely. Sammy asks them about Chicago, saying he's heard there's no Jim Crow laws and a black man can go where he wants. And then Smoke tells him not to believe everything he hears. Chicago is just like the South, just with tall buildings instead of plantations.
Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting. They filmed the movie down in Louisiana, and the scenes of them driving the dirt roads with the cotton fields on each side is really beautiful.
Yeah.
But it's also a sign of oppression and, of course, their awful past
exactly.
as slaves. So it's like, it's beautiful, but it's also kind of depressing, too, when you think about it. I mean, yes, they're free, technically, now, but they're still working, barely making any money, and they're all poor. So, yeah. So what did you think about the bit with the snake in their truck? Yeah, I think it was a cotton mouth, I guess.
Well, and about the evil hiding in with the liquor.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, I like that. Know? Yeah, that's good point. Yeah. If only Stack hadn't pushed Smoke to open that night.
Yep.
I wonder if things would have changed. The Choctaw Hunters may have caught Remick and destroyed him.
Yeah.
And none of this would have ever happened. When they have to split up, you get the impression that rarely happens with the twins.
It's always together.
Yeah, Smoke is adamant that Sammy has to watch his brother's back. They hug and they say they love each other, and I like that. Despite,
I do too.
These guys are like hard. I mean, they're soldiers, they're gangsters.
Yeah.
But they still show affection.
And that's okay.
Yes.
I do not buy into toxic masculinity. It is okay to hug you, buddy. I promise.
Yeah.
I'm just putting that out there.
Yeah. Smoke goes into town and asks a teenage girl to watch the truck while he talks to the Chows. His reunion with Bo is interrupted by her blowing the horn, and he shoots one of the would-be thieves right in the ass.
Yep.
Then he shoots the other guy in the leg just because he didn't want to get around that the guy got away unscathed.
Yep, exactly.
I mean, then he gives Bo money to help patch them up.
Yeah, that's what gets me. I'm like, really?
I like how they established these characters' moral code, loose as it is, by showing us, not telling us.
Yep.
I mean, the Chows ask if they hit it big in the casino. Smoke says they hit, just not the way he thinks. So they basically, like, rob the mob.
I know.
And
it makes you think that if things hadn't happened here, if they hadn't had all, I wonder if the mob would have come for them anyway.
Yeah, I mean, they went right back to where they were from.
Yeah.
It'd been easy enough to find them. If they'd settled somewhere else, they might not have ever found him. In the car, Sammy asked something they promised to tell him about when he got older. Did they kill their father? Stack says they didn't. Smoke did. Their father knocked Stack unconscious, and when he came to, Smoke was half-finished burying him.
Yep.
And he says that he asked, did your dad beat you a lot? And he said, mostly me. But Stack had a smart mouth, probably.
Yeah.
He was the funny one of the two. He was more of the smart ass. And Smoke was the no-nonsense one that... But, I mean, we'll get to that in a minute, because Stack lies to Sammy, saying the guitar they gave him was Charlie Patton's. It was a famous blues guitarist that they won from him in a card game.
Yeah.
So, it makes me wonder, did they lie? Did he lie about them killing their dad, too? Or do you think? Or
no.
You think that's true?
Oh, yeah.
I think it is, too. But, he lied about the guitar, but so I don't know. And oddly enough, the guitar later we find out is their dad's.
Yeah.
So, but I love when he starts singing, Sammy starts singing, Stack's jaw just drops like, this voice came out of my little cousin.
Yeah, because it's, oh, man.
Just like, damn. God, that kid's got a voice on him. Then we meet Delta Slim, played by Delroy Lindo. Slim initially turns down Stack's offer, saying he's going to be playing at Messengers just like he does every Saturday night. He's been doing it for 10 years, and it'll be there another 10 years, and that's probably about all the time he's got left, if he only knew.
I know.
And he asks if their joint is going to be there next week, too. So, no, it's not. And Messengers is a real place in Clarksdale. It's still open today, so Slim was right.
Oh,
yeah,
there you go.
Yeah. Ironic that Stack lured Slim to play for them with $40 and all the Chicago Irish beer he can drink, considering they're going to be tempted and overtaken by an Irish vampire.
Oh.
Delta Slim is played by Delroy Lindo, who is best known for Get Shorty and Malcolm X, but always brings gravitas and everything he's in. Slim is part wise old man and comic relief in this film, and he really sells it.
Mm-hmm.
He's really good. When I saw he was in this, I was like, this movie's got a really good cast.
Yes, yeah.
Just like, which at this point, I mean, I think anybody's going to sign up for a Ryan Coogler movie at this point, but still. But Sammy's got some play with Perlene, doesn't he? She tells him he's married, and he asks, happily?
I know. I'm like, dang.
Perlene is played by Jamie Lawson, known for The Woman King and playing the same character in both the Batman film and the Penguin TV series.
Okay.
Yeah, so she's one of those connections between those two, you know. While all the stuff's going on, it's like, where the hell's Batman? I mean, I love that series, but at the end, I'm like, wouldn't Batman have shown up by now?
At some point,
at some point, yeah. I guess you can say the same thing about Peacemaker. Where the hell's Superman? You know, but... And then Sammy catches Mary staring at Stack and warns him, just like Smoke asked. Their confrontation is very short, but man, you get everything you need to know about them in this brief conversation.
Yep.
Stack told her he loved her, they had sex, but he also told her to stay away from him. Her mom helped raise them, and she's angry that they didn't show up at her funeral yesterday, which is why she's back in this town. And then to send her off, Stack lies and says she never meant anything to them but food and a warm bed, the mom.
Yeah.
Now, that's economical writing and acting.
I know.
I mean, it just like, boom, 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 boom. Here's everything, you know, right out there. Mary is played by Haley Steinfeld, who is a singer herself, and along with Catton, sings songs on the soundtrack. And, of course, she's best known to geeks for Bumblebee, the Hawkeye series, and voicing Gwen Stacy in the Spider-Verse animated films. So.
And Pitch Perfect.
And she's in Pitch Perfect, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, there's another Marvel connection in this film, and of course there's going to be another one later, besides a good chunk of the cast. Some of the period costumes used in this film were from the stalled Blade reboot with Mahershala Ali. Apparently, part of the movie was to be set in this period.
Oh. Okay.
I guess when Blade is born, maybe?
I don't know.
I mean, if it follows now, the comics. So.
Now, here's my question. Is that stalled or is it done?
Depends on who you ask.
Okay.
I don't know if it's ever going to happen. You know, maybe Wesley Snipes right. There's only ever going to be one Blade. I don't know. On the ride to pick up cornbread, they drive by a chain gang where Slim knows everyone. He tells them about his friend Rice and how they made a bunch of money playing for some white sheriffs who picked them up for vagrancy. When Rice was found with all that money, a story was made up of him robbing a white man and raping his wife, and he was hung for it.
Yeah.
And they cut his... off too.
Yeah.
If you listen in the background, you can hear everything happening that he's talking about.
Yeah.
Which I think's really, it's like, if you're not really paying attention, you won't catch that. But you hear him, you hear the rope, the drop, and you hear him, you know, I mean, it's awful. That's a very sobering moment to remind us, despite the current jubilation and the horror to come, real horror happened to these people.
Yes.
Yeah. Then they pick up cornbread out of the cotton fields. Stack is getting kind of nasty about Cornbread's wife, which he's like going to threaten to, you know, whoop Stack for it.
Yeah.
But as long as he pays him well, she doesn't really care.
Yeah. Well.
Just think about all these family members who are going to be lost the next day.
I know.
I mean, Cornbread's wife, he ain't ever coming home. I mean, Sammy is alive, but he ain't coming home, you know.
Yeah.
Mary never made it back to her husband, you know, which apparently not too happy with him. And Perlene never makes it back to her husband.
No.
I mean, geez. We finally meet Annie, played by Wunmi Masaku, who geeks know as B-15 from the MCU series Loki and the film Deadpool and Wolverine. She's also in Lovecraft Country, so this isn't her first horror.
No.
So they never say, do you think these two were actually married or just a couple that had a baby together? And that
I thought they did say that they were married.
I didn't quite catch it. Maybe they...
I think they did.
Okay. Maybe they did. Maybe they did. Smoke criticizes her selling her hoodoo remedies to kids and taking plantation money because, according to him, only money is power. And she points out that he and Stack survived World War I and gangland violence in Chicago thanks to the praying she's done and the mojo bag that he wears.
Yes.
With the hoodoo, you know, ceremony she performs over it. He asks why it didn't work on their baby, which is just heartbreaking.
It is.
It's like, ugh.
You just gotta wonder.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I mean, it shows him visit the... He said,
the gray,
it
yeah.
says, Papa's here, you know. Yeah. That's, he got the flowers from the chows from their place. It's obvious there's still a lot of heat between these two,
mm-hmm.
which is proven by them having sex right there in the shack.
Yep.
Standing up.
Yeah.
That's kind of a shocker.
I know. But I mean, you know.
They don't show anything, but they clearly are, you know, I mean, they don't show any nudity, but...
Oh, yeah. But you know what they're doing.
Oh, you know exactly what they're doing, yeah. Then Remick jumps into the frame, much like Mad Peter did in The Reptile.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that.
Yeah.
He's covered in lesions and his body is smoking. I'm guessing the Choctaw hunters found him hiding somewhere and chased him out before sunset, you
yeah,
reckon?
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. Actor Jack O'Connell is best known for the films Start Up and Unbroken. I wasn't familiar with him before.
I mean,
this.
Either at all.
Yeah, but he's really great in this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He's kind of, I mean, there's at some moments you kind of actually like the guy, and then you're like, then he says and does something, you're like, oh, no.
Yeah.
Bert and Joan are obviously involved in the Klan, so our sympathy for what's about to happen to them ebbs pretty fast.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well.
Like,
you know.
Yeah. Just
they're just poor little rednecks.
Yeah, yeah. Bert is played by Peter Germanis, a singer for the band July Talk. This is his first film role, as far as I can tell. Joan is played by Lola Kirk, known for Gone Girl and the TV miniseries Winning Time, The Rise of the Lakers Dynasty. So they both, she's got a pretty good IMDb, but, you know, he's mostly just his music videos before this.
Okay.
Notice when the Choctaw ride up, there are three large birds circling Bert and Joan's house.
Yeah.
So that, I guess that represents Remick, Bert, and Joan.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I would watch a prequel spinoff series of these Choctaw vampire hunters.
Yes.
Chaitin, their leader, is played by Nathaniel Arkand, best known for Killers of the Flower Moon. Ginger Snaps Back, another horror, which I've never seen any of those Ginger Snaps movies. We need to watch those. Those about the teenage vampire, teenage werewolf girls.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we need to watch those. And he's also it from the TV series FBI Most Wanted. So he tries to warn Annie, and, you know, she just, you know, keeps the gun on him. So they go on their way because the sun's getting ready to go down.
Yeah.
But again, come, you know, I don't want anybody messing this movie up, but they could make a sidequel of those guys.
Yes.
And it wouldn't mess this movie up. So,
no.
So there you go. There you go, Ryan Coogler. I know you don't need my help in getting your projects going, but I'd like to see that. So.
Yeah, me too.
But then the shot of Annie finding Remick sitting in the rocking chair, his mouth covered in blood and Bert dead in the floor, then rising. That's one of those pure horror moments of this
yes.
film. It reminds me a lot of vampirized Jeffrey Lewis from the original Salem's Lot, which Coogler cited as an influence when they open that door and he's just sitting there in a rocking chair and his eyes are all, you know, lit up.
Yes.
And it's all, ugh. That's a creepy damn movie. We could do that sometime, too. I remember we were both taken aback by the baby crib in the room.
Yeah.
But we thought the worst, you know.
I know, me too.
Like, because there's some of that in Nosferatu, and we're like, I'm like, oh God, no, please no. I do not want her mad to come out of this movie. We've well established this season, guys. No dogs, no pets.
No.
No dogs, cats, no kids.
Nope.
Murdered in these horror movies.
I don't care what you do to the adults, but you leave the babies and the pets alone.
And you can line up all the white supremacist assholes and kill them left and right. We don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Especially them. But apparently Coogler said they were trying for a baby and hadn't had one yet. So also saved us from having another racist born.
Yeah.
There you go.
Because the kid probably, well, he might have grown out of it, but eh, probably not. Those three birds are circling Club Juke when it opens, too. Mm-hmm. See? Yeah. I've never heard it. I just noticed it. I'm not, you know, I'm sure it's there for, on purpose.
Yeah.
It's there for a reason, because I'm sure it's a digital effect. You know, they didn't, like, train three hawks to circle the building, you know. We get some of the plot set up we talked about in the synopsis. Smoke's upset with Stack and Annie for taking plantation money and wooden nickels. For instance, Cornbread doesn't recognize Mary at first and almost bars her at the door, but he does know her and gives her a hug. And their closeness makes everything more tragic later. It's like everybody knows each other.
Yes.
In this film. Whether
it's a small community.
Yeah, yeah. So through her conversations with Sammy, Smoke, and Stack, we learn Mary's father was half black, and her mother not only helped raise Smoke and Stack, she nursed them after their own mother died.
Yes.
So I guess their mother died in childbirth.
Or shortly thereafter.
Stack set her up with a rich white man in Arkansas, but Mary says she didn't even want to identify as white. Stack admits he loves her and thinks about her every day, but he wanted to protect her from the Klan and keep her safe and away from him, since she could never be safe with him.
Yeah.
Yeah, which, I mean, with their lifestyle, you know, that's probably why, you know, another reason why Annie's not with them either, because, you know, those guys are, you know, they, at one point, they basically mentioned that they were pimps, or at least Stack was, too. So it's like, I mean, these guys aren't good guys, you know what I'm saying? They're not, like, you know, they've killed a lot of people and probably, and not all of it justified, I'm sure, but
they were enforcers for Al Capone.
Yeah. Based on how it turns out, they do stay together forever, though, and seem legitimately happy when we see them at the end.
Yeah.
And they certainly don't have to worry about bigots hurting them at which we'll get into as, you know, as we talk about what vampirism means in this movie. So when Sammy plays his song, I Lied to You, we get Annie repeating her narration about music that's so pure it can pierce the veil between life and death. And then we see musicians from all across time playing with them. What did you think about this in the theater?
I mean, it was one of those cases. They said it pierced the realm between, you know, between the past and the future. So,
but did you for a brief second think, oh, is this movie jumping the shark right here? Did that flash through your head, or did you?
The first time I saw it, it almost pulled me out for a second.
Yeah.
But the second time, I was like, oh, you know.
Yeah, it's like, I guess I didn't, you know, the first time you watch it, you know, a lot of movies start with opening narration that you only kind of half pay attention to.
Yeah.
Because you're not into the movie yet. You know, the trailers have just ended. You've turned your phone off. You're still eating popcorn. And you don't quite soak that in.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't know that. It's like, no, you really need to pay attention to this, because I mean, there's going to be a funk guitarist in a LL Cool J style hip hop artist in a minute, you know, like 1980s LL Cool J in a minute, you know. And so it's like, wow, it did take me out for a second too. And I'm like, but then when they kept going with it, I'm like, oh, okay, this is the thing.
Yeah.
And then when the roof catches on fire and literally the whole building burns down around them, and I love Cornbread still sitting outside. It's like, it's just the building burned down. I know it didn't literally burn down, but visually it did. And Cornbread's just like waiting at the door, you know, waiting. He's playing. He's the doorman. But yeah, I mean, we see a lot of black singers, dancers, hip hop artists, and DJs, but we see the Chows dancing and also see dancers from Chinese history too.
Yes.
Which I think that's a nice touch. Yeah. So, but of course, this is what attracts Remick, Bert, and Joan. I get the feeling they are actually seeing what Coogler is showing us, like with the building burning down. What do you think?
I think Remick is seeing that because, you know, he is the old vampire and everything else.
Also the only one with red eyes. The rest all have green eyes.
Or I thought they were more like a silver
green. Yeah, but they're not red, but like they're the person, not like my green eyes, but like, you know, piercing green, you know, light bulb green eyes, yeah.
I love your green eyes.
Thank you. Don't embarrass the listeners.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Sammy uses some advice Stack gave him earlier, and let's just say pleases Pearlene.
Oh, preacher boy.
Which I love that the stack up is like up against the door and he's like, mm.
Yeah, he's like, oh.
We'll let you guys, we're not going to get it. We'll try to keep this mostly, you know, mostly
PG-13.
Mostly PG-13, yeah. Cornbread bars Remick and his group at the door. Then the twins, Annie, Mary, and Sammy all come to see what's going on. They say they just want to drink, eat, and play music. Then the show, they are legit. They go into a very pleasant version of the song, I Pick Poor Robin Clean.
Mm-hmm.
This bit looks like something out of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah.
I mean, it really, which this movie kind of gives me like, it's like the black Oh Brother, Where Art Thou with horror.
Yeah.
Plus in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, you've got the character that is their friend that, you know, they, that sells his soul to the devil at the mm-hmm. crossroads
yep.
and they have to save from the clan. So, you know,
there's parallels
here. It's the same time period. I was waiting for George Clooney to show up, go, we're in a tight spot.
Yeah.
Also great soundtracks. So,
yeah.
Smoke tells them to go find one of the white barrel houses in town. Remick is offended at their racism. And I guess it makes sense when you find out about their community later, that he really doesn't, like, he doesn't see any difference between people, which is, again, we'll get into that later, but it's like, it's kind of interesting coming from a vampire.
Right, and they're like, well, she's here, when they point at Mary, and Annie's like, well, she's family.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. And that comes back up later, too.
Mm-hmm.
Smoke threatens to draw his gun, and they finally walk off. Annie says they give her the willy. Stack's line is funny, but also probably true and disturbing. He said, well, white folks at night will do that to you.
Yeah.
You know, it's not funny, but it kind of is just the way he said it. Things get pretty tense when Smoke tells Sammy he doesn't want him pursuing the life of a blues musician. Much like Stack with Mary, he's trying to keep him safe. And he even pulls his gun on him to prove his point.
Yeah.
Smoke is self-actualized enough to know he doesn't want to pull Sammy away from the good upbringing and family he has.
Mm-hmm.
He's basically like, stay away from us, you know, and our lifestyle, you know. Meanwhile, Mary volunteers to talk to Remick's crew because they need real money to break even that night. Ooh, bad mistake. As we'll get into it, ultimately, though, is it a bad mistake for Mary? I don't know.
I know.
When she walks up there playing an Irish folk song, Will Ye Go, Lassie Go, and Jack O'Connell said he took the part in this film so he could actually sing these Irish songs since his father is Irish.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah. They show her the gold coins from another place and time, so Remick is probably pretty old, also based on what he says later.
Well, they're Roman coins from when the Romans invaded Ireland.
Yeah.
That's what they're from.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're... you know, right at BC times.
Yeah. Because, I mean, he talks about later that when the Christians came and basically forced a religion on him, you know, he hated them, but the words gave him comfort. So he was there when they brought in the Lord's Prayer, you know. So, I mean, this guy's ancient. Yeah. But he's picked up I like how he goes back and forth between his Irish accent and his Southern accent, you know. So it's kind of funny. Then they get a little too familiar, noting she's sad, and she tells them why, that her mom passed away, and Remick says he'd wished he'd met her sooner because he could have saved her mother from her fate, but he can still save her, and his eyes go red, and he begins to drool, and the drooling is pretty gross, as we shall see.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, she pulls the gun Stack gave her out of her stocking garter and tells them they need to leave, but she turns her back on them, which... don't ever turn your back on somebody like that. Blink and you'll miss that Remick actually leaves the ground behind her. So he's like, you know, flying. He's floating. And I'm sure
at least leaping.
I'm sure he literally just comes in for that bite because we find out later that she's got that bite on her shoulder.
Yeah.
Or back of her shoulder. If you weren't sure before, the old vampire trope of needing an invitation to enter is key to the plot of this film, as Mary has to ask to come back in.
Mm-hmm.
So, Smoke and Sammy get involved with a guy cheating at dice who cuts up another patron. They find the dice, and Smoke orders the guys to stomp on the perpetrator while Pearlene sings and stomps on stage, and Stack and Mary get hot and heavy. So there's a lot of stomping and a lot of...
heeing and sheeing.
A little heeing and sheeing going on, yeah. Stack notes, she's drooling. Then she asks him if he wants some, and she drools in his mouth. I'm sorry, but at what point is that sexy?
Nope.
I'm not trying to kink shame, but damn, that's just gross.
It is. Yep. Don't you ever.
Believe me, I ain't never going to do that. That's disgusting. Again, if you're into that, then just don't tell us, because yeah. I think it's gross.
Yep.
Stack pulls down Mary's dress, and as I say, we see that huge, nasty bite mark. I mean, it's like his whole teeth.
Yes.
Like on the back of her shoulder. Sammy goes to get Stack to stitch up the guy, and Slim knows what Stack and Mary are doing, but jokingly sends Sammy in the room anyway. At this point, she's not bitten him yet. They're just, like you said, heeing and a sheeing, as Jerry Reed would say. Then Smoke comes in with Sammy, and we see Mary is feeding on him. She gets off of him, and Smoke sees the blood just shooting out of Stack's neck.
Yes.
And he pulls his pistols and just starts firing on her. She drops, but when she quickly comes to up giggling and she says her line, you know.
Yeah, we gonna kill every last one of you.
Yeah. Notice her eyes are green, not red, as I said.
Yeah.
So this was revealed in the trailer. But it's still kind of shocking they turned Hailee Steinfeld first like this.
Yes.
Like one of the biggest stars in this film, and she's like the first one of them to turn into a vampire.
Yeah.
It's not Pearlene. It's not somebody that's more of a, you know, more of a supporting player. It's like one of the stars.
Yeah.
That's kind of surprising. Her running out and laughing and threatening to come back reminded me a lot of the Evil Dead films. Yeah. You know, like I was waiting for her to pull her head off and dance naked, like, you know, in Evil Dead 2, Ash's girlfriend. Stack's death is pretty brutal. He's still conscious enough to say, she bit me, you know, over and over.
Yeah.
And tell Smoke he's scared, but he does say he loves him before he expires.
Yeah.
The disbelief on Smoke's face as he tries to keep the blood from spurting out is just heartbreaking. I mean, this tough guy is just a helpless little boy at this point.
He loves his brother.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, they are twins, so there's that whole...
That extra connection.
Yeah. Annie knows they are dealing with something supernatural. She calls it a haint at first. She is our Van Helsing.
Yeah.
In this film, obviously. Yeah. Slim tells everyone to go home, sending them out like lambs to the slaughter.
I was just like, oh.
He doesn't know that, but Grace tells Bo to go get the car. And I mean, she's kind of like, he just lost his brother. It's like, we didn't ask for this. We got to get out of here. We got to get home.
Yeah.
That bites her in the ass. I mean, if she just stayed with them, you know, and also she's the one that F's it up for everybody, you know, so I mean. This moment is like pretty pivotal to what happens. Actually, her like just like, I don't want no part of this. I'm not, you know, we didn't ask for this, you know, and because he's like, we need to stay with him. His brother just got killed, you know. Cornbread returns and Annie wonders why he needs an invitation to come back inside.
Yeah,
I love how this movie adds several interesting new wrinkles to the vampire myth, but it also adheres to the old legends more than some. What you'd call quote-unquote pure gothic vampire flicks.
Yeah.
You know. After a pretty long argument and some ropey explanations from Cornbread, Smoke reluctantly agrees to at least pay him, and he tries to bite his arm.
Yeah.
His eyes go green, too. Smoke shoots him right through the cheek, and one side is blown out, but he gets right back up. It's really pretty gross, but... they close and lock the door while everyone is freaking out, and Slim asks... Hey, y'all smell something? Because I think I shat myself. It's a funny line, and it relieves the tension just a bit.
Oh, yeah.
You know, yeah, that's one of those, you know, tension relief. You know, let the air out of the tire just a little bit, you know. Just, you know, so that's one of those moments. Stack comes to behind the door and wants out. Everyone is weirded out, but Annie warns Smoke that's not his brother. And he says, you want to let that witch come between us again? So apparently they had a falling out at some point with Annie involved.
Yeah.
I wonder if it was like, that's maybe the time that maybe they split up for a while, the twins, and he thought they had the kid. But then when the kid died, he ran back off with him again.
See, I think that's what happened.
Yeah, that's me just kind of guessing. I guess you agree too, because we hadn't talked about that before. But he gets angry pretty quickly. And I love how everyone is so unsettled by this. Annie runs off. But Smoke actually asked her for the key. So he was going to let him out.
Yeah.
He busts out anyway, and the heavy wooden door just lands on Sammy. It's a wonder it didn't, like, crush his, you know. I thought, oh, man, are they going to, like, crush his, you know, hands so he, can't play anymore, you know. I didn't know what the ending was going to be, obviously. And he throws pickled garlic on Stack, and he burns and runs out. And she said, these ain't Haints. They're vampires. Yeah, the old garlic trick, you know. This is when Annie tells him what they need to have to defend themselves. Garlic, wooden stakes, silver, and holy water.
Yeah.
She describes Haints as a spirit that switches places with the soul of a person. But vampires are different. The soul gets stuck in the body, and they can't rejoin their ancestors. Cursed to live here with all this hate, is what she said.
Yeah.
But other than being stuck, that's the opposite of how the vampires describe their condition later.
Yes.
Very interesting that Coogler makes this state of being very gray and not just evil and monstrous, other than wanting to kill everyone. But they have their own reasons for doing that, too. It's not just feeding.
No.
I don't even know if these vampires, do they need to drink blood? They don't really go into that, like they need to do it. Are they just doing it to just turn?
Create a other, community.
Yeah, a community. Yeah, because, I mean, they never. And later, at the end, jumping forward, he does drink the, Stack drinks the same whiskey or whatever that Sammy drinks. I'll have what he is having.
Yeah.
So he can, a lot of times, you know, like, I can never drink wine, you know, I never drink wine, you know, that, yeah. Like Dracula, you know, they can't eat or drink regular food.
Well, and she's sucking on that lollipop the whole time.
Right, yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe they do feed, but that's not important to these vampires. Smoke asks that maybe if they kill the ones that made him this way, he turned back. But she says while they have a connection, even if they kill the master, they don't say that, but, you know, they still live on. Which, I mean, that's a trope that's like, that comes up sometimes with werewolves, not as much with vampires.
Yeah, if you kill the one who made them, then they revert.
If you kill the, if they're not quite a full vampire like Mina in Dracula, and you kill the vampire, but if they're dead and they rise, of course, in this movie, they're dead and they rise instantly, which I generally don't like that in vampire movies. I like them to be dead.
Have some time, yeah.
Yeah, and then they rise up out of the grave, and a lot of times it's 3 days, which I think that's kind of, you know, it's like, oh, it's kind of, you know.
Well, it was supposed to be in parallel to Christianity.
I know it, yeah. But, I mean, it's kind of, you know, blasphemous, I guess.
Yeah.
Sammy blames himself for repeating what his dad said about the devil following his music, and he's not really wrong. I mean, he did follow him there.
Yeah.
He did, the music did call him there. Annie asks Smoke to stake her if she's bitten. He, of course, is reluctant, but you know this was going to happen when she asked about
it.
Oh,
yeah.
You're like, oh, man, they're going to kill Annie. You know?
Yeah.
Either that or he's not going to have the balls to do it and she's going to be a vampire.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, she's going to die and, you know. They find a patron and what appears to be a pool of blood in the floor, so they dump him out.
Outside,
yeah. They find out later he just got way too into the corn liquor.
Can I say my theory?
Yeah, go ahead. But I have it in the notes, but go ahead.
Well, my theory is you know, later on in the movie, the clan come to get him. I personally think, and they say that they bought the corn liquor there in town.
Yeah.
I think that they planned to drug all of the black people there, and the clan was going to come in and either A, hand them an ass whooping, or kill them all.
Or burn the building down.
Or burn the building down with them in it. And I think that this guy got into the corn liquor because if you notice, everybody else was drinking
the Irish beer.
The Irish beer, and he got into the corn liquor. Now that's my theory.
Yeah, I looked that up and I didn't see where that was, because I thought you were probably right, but I think that's just your theory. But I actually think it makes. It makes the clan's plan make more sense.
Well, and otherwise, why else would they still be there by the light of day?
Yeah, I mean,
you know,
they would only, the twins might be there and a few of the people that work there, but I mean, why would they still be there then? Why didn't they come later at night, like, you know, or, I mean, we'll get into that at the end, but I do like your theory, and I kind of wish it was the way it was, but I don't think it is, but it's a good theory. I like it.
Well, it's now the theory. It's now the thing.
I subscribe to your newsletter.
Okay.
Yeah. I subscribe to your Sinners fan fiction. Smoke and Sammy drop him outside. Then they hear and see Remick and all the vampires they've turned having an Irish jig, singing and dancing to The Rocky Road to Dublin. Remick is a heck of a good dancer.
Uh-huh.
He's the lord of the undead dance.
Oh, my hands.
Michael Flatley's got nothing on him. Stack, Mary, and Cornbread are there, too. And they know the words, so, of course, that connection we'll learn about later is even evident now. Why would they know the words to that?
Right.
All the turned vampires have green eyes. Remick has red, which, like I pointed out, it's kind of like lightsabers, I guess. Mary makes them all eat a clove of garlic since they think someone in there bit that guy.
Yeah.
Pearline almost gets herself shot for not wanting to taste it. Sammy tries to get him to put the gun down and he hits him in the mouth.
With the butt of it.
I know. Pearline says, "You're an evil man. No wonder the devil come for us." Slim makes a scene, so you start to think he's the guy, but he's just drank too much and his stomach's messed up, plus his nerves.
Yeah.
Yeah. They realize that it was just the liquor, so they go to let the guy in, but Cornbread jumps on him and bites him right as they open
the door. Yeah.
While they watch in terror, Bo walks up and nonchalantly tells Grace to go with him because he got the car started.
Yeah.
And she's like, he's killing that guy. And he's like, oh, Cornbread's always hungry, you know. But she's like, Grace is confused, but Smoke says they'll find a way out. And Remick walks up and says he is their way out. He talks about how they aren't allowed to build or to fellowship, but that will all change if they join them. But then he threatens to go visit the Grace's daughter, Lisa, and says he knows all Bo knows. He speaks in Chinese about how Grace likes to be licked. We'll just leave it at that. So this guy isn't as evil pious as he comes across sometimes. Uh-huh. He's just evil. And then he tells Sammy he came for him. His gifts can reunite him with his ancestors. If they hand Sammy over, he'll let them all live, the rest of them. They, of course, refuse, but Remick points out Smoke couldn't even save his own brother, who, of course, walks up. He tells them they built something beautiful, but it was built on a lie, Remick says. Hogwood is the grand dragon of the clan, and Bert is his nephew.
Uh-huh.
They plan to kill everyone there.
See, that's the reason I think... You know, that's another reason why I'm like, hey, they planned it ahead, and they got the corn liquor from town.
Yeah. I don't want people to think that that's your theory. I have to say that. That's your theory. But that's good. I like it. Because it doesn't make sense that they wait and show up in the morning.
No.
It really doesn't. They just didn't want to cross the vampires with the clan. I actually liked to have seen the vampires kill the... Well, it was more satisfying to see... Smoke kill him, though, honestly.
Yeah. Anyway.
Stack backs it up, saying he can see Remick's memories. The club was a slaughterhouse, a killing floor. Remick says they'll probably rectify Hogwood, too.
Yeah.
They'll go into town and rectify him, too. But, again, that whole thing about the slaughterhouse and the killing floor, and they point out, what's this on the floor?
Floor. See, I think it was a clan meeting place.
Yeah, probably so. Yeah, and they's like, well, we'll just, these guys, you know, it just happens, like, oh, we'll sell it to you, you know.
Yeah.
Annie asks why they can't just go, and Mary walks up and says they aren't leaving without them because we're family.
Mm-hmm.
So she uses those words against her.
Yeah.
That she said that earlier, yeah. She says,
I know it sounds crazy, but after we kill y'all, we gonna have heaven right here on earth.
Yeah, that does sound crazy.
Yeah.
Stack tells Smoke, they were never going to be free, but this is the way. And when he said that, I couldn't help it. I thought of the Mandalorian. God help me. I said, this is the way. They'll be free and together forever. Smoke almost walks forward, but everyone pulls him back and shuts the door.
Yeah.
So other than the violent death, this sales pitch doesn't sound bad, though, does it?
No.
I mean, it really does, especially for people who are living under such oppression their entire lives.
And they're marginalized.
They're marginalized. The whites, black, and Chinese are all getting along in what seems to be a true brotherhood. I mean, the freaking Klan people that had a hood in their house are now, you know, brotherhooding with blacks and Chinese, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, it's kind of like a hive mind. But everyone still has their personality because Stack still speaks like Stack.
Yeah.
And Mary still speaks like Mary. They're like a sacrilegious Borg in some ways.
Yeah, you know? I can see that.
Grace wants to act now. Smoke tells her to let him think, and she asks if he was a soldier. Didn't he shoot two guys earlier for touching his truck? She points out they killed Stack and Bo and threatened Lisa. She's got a point, but she really does cock everything up, doesn't she?
Oh my gosh, yes.
The vampires circle the building, singing Pick Poor Robin Clean Again, and Grace snaps. And Smoke and Annie try to stop her, but she bites Smoke's hand and yells, "Come on in, you
MFers."
Yeah. I'm surprised they didn't just kill Grace right there.
Yeah.
Coogler said he wanted the pace of this film to be like a Metallica song, particularly one, which of course starts out kind of beautiful and serene, but while still dark, but by the end it's just this balls-to-the-wall metal thrasher.
Yeah.
This is where Kirk Hammett really cuts into his guitar solo at this point in the movie.
Yeah.
I believe Lars Ulrich from Metallica actually contributed to the orchestra in this film, too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So there is a Metallica connection.
Component, yeah.
I'm surprised Kirk Hammett wasn't involved because he's such the horror guy.
Oh, that's true.
He is the huge horror collection. I've got a book he put out, Too Much Horror Business, that is just full of all the props and movie posters and toys and stuff he's got. That's just, ugh. But anyway, the soundtrack was composed and produced by Ludwig Göransson, who did a fantastic job. The soundtrack reminds me again of Oh Brother Where Art Thou, with the cast and other genre artists contributing both original and traditional songs. And Buddy Guy actually played on the soundtrack too. So, I mean, it's like they got all these great musicians from all these different, from the blues and also other, other blues-influenced music to play on this. So, yeah, it's a really great soundtrack. But of course, getting back to the movie, the battle begins, and the screen ratio actually changes, giving us a taller image.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess this is, I think they said like Christopher Nolan and his wife like helped Coogler figure out some of the IMAX
shots
and stuff. You know, he's kind of a pioneer. I mean, he is a pioneer in that. And so he helped them like go big with the camera and I don't understand all that stuff. I honestly don't, but I just know that Nolan's one of the guys that's like an expert on it. Grace throws a Molotov cocktail at Remick, who swats it at the open door, and then she makes a beeline for Bo and knocks him into the door, setting them both on fire, and she stakes him while she's screaming, and they both burn to death.
I know.
It's like, damn. I mean, and she's like the first one out, and she's the one that
brought everything there.
It's like, I don't know if waiting it out would have done much good, but
They could have waited them out till morning.
I know, that's what they said. Wait them out till morning. That was the plan. They literally couldn't get in. And I know if they hadn't threatened the kid, she wouldn't have done it. But still, and Slim even said, they look like they're staying here. They're not leaving.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of great gory action here. But I will say, there seem to be more survivors inside the barn, the mill, than we saw before. Maybe not, but otherwise the dozens of vampires would have wiped them out pretty quickly. It's like a bat fight on Batman 66. All of a sudden the villains have four or five extra henchmen. I mean, there was like one extra guy that was never named in a pair of bibbed overalls. I think he was the only other non-main guy that we saw in there with them.
Yeah.
But now there seem to be more of them, so I don't know. They do follow the stake them, but then pull it out. Rule, which I really don't care for in vampire fiction. The stakes should remain because it goes back to the vampire myth of people literally pinning dead bodies to the ground that they believed had been getting up and walking around as the undead.
Yeah, but with Buffy,
I know, but I didn't like that on Buffy.
Okay.
I mean, she literally stabbed him and they turned to dust. I always thought that was like, oh, it's too convenient. I know that was so there wouldn't be a pile of bodies. Like, why are all these bodies piled up everywhere and,
Yeah.
But it's, to me, it's like, that's the whole, and then, when you pull it out, then the vampire can come back, that's if some dumbass pulls it out, so. Annie splashes Remick with garlic or holy water, I don't know which, because she was doing her hoodoo on, so she might have made holy water with that, I don't know.
Yeah.
And she tells Smoke they feel his pain, and then Stack bites her.
Stack does it.
Yeah. Smoke tries to help, but Remick gets on top of him, and Annie says,
"Not you."
Yeah, over and over. Yeah, it's like, oh, man. That's got, and that's his twin, and,
yeah.
Oh, it's just like, ugh. Pearline blasts both Stack and Remick, but it's too late. Annie reminds Smoke what he promised, and that she'll see him soon. And she has somebody waiting for her.
Yes.
He hesitates, but Smoke says, I love you, and stabs her with the stake. And Mary and Stack cry out. They really wanted that family reunion.
And she even says, Annie!
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like, they were like, you know, we're going to all be together, you know, soon when we get you guys over this. And, you know, according to them, Smoke just screwed it up. So I have no idea why the vampires retreat temporarily at this point. Yes, some were destroyed and all of them were shot, which it just temporarily stops them.
Yeah.
You know, but they have been shooting them with regular bullets. But they could have easily taken who was left. This is simply story structure dictating what happens next.
Yep.
I mean, that there's no real reason for them to back off at all. Slim slits his wrist with a bottle after taking a drink and sends Smoke, Sammy, and Pearline up the stairs to get out through the loft while the vampires dogpile on him. I thought maybe the first time we saw this in the theater, I'd missed where he had gotten bitten.
Right.
But no, he just...
He sacrificed himself for... I'm not sure why.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like... I mean, he distracted them, but it's like... They'd honestly kind of run out of the building already, so I don't. If they barred the door, could they have got back in? Did they have to ask again? I mean,
I know.
I don't think they do.
Well, I think they would have to ask again because see, Mary couldn't get back in because after she left.
Oh, that's true, and neither could Stack.
Yeah.
Why didn't they just go lock the? They all ran out. Why didn't they go lock the damn door?
I don't know.
And he wouldn't have had to kill himself.
I know.
Now I'm finding plot holes in this movie. Damn it.
I'm sorry.
I know. It's like, don't ever do a podcast about anything you love because you'll always find stuff wrong with it. Rebek meets the remaining humans at the loft door and Pearline tries to stake him but misses his heart. He bites her and Smoke shoots Rebek away for the moment. Sammy leaps from the loft with his guitar and I guess he sprains his leg because he's limping after that. But I mean, hell, it's like two stories up.
Yeah, exactly.
Rebek attacks Sammy as he runs away and slashes him across the face.
With his nails.
Yep, which never heals.
Nope.
It scars anyway. He lands in the pond nearby and Rebek pulls him up, telling him he wants his songs and his stories and he'll share his too. Sammy starts saying the Lord's Prayer and Rebek joins in. Along with the other vampires.
Yes.
Very creepy.
Yes.
So it's kind of interesting that maybe why would holy water work if they can say the Lord's Prayer? You know? Maybe it wasn't holy water. Maybe she said holy water, but maybe it was just more garlic.
Garlic, yeah.
It was just more garlic, yeah. Like I said, Rebek says he learned those words from the men who stole his father's land. He hated those men, but those words still bring him comfort. You know, again, like we said, this points to him being very old. And pointing out that people are always being oppressed by some group that has supposedly lofty goals.
Yeah.
He keeps dousing him in the water like it's a twisted baptism, though.
Yeah.
I thought that was like an old school, you know, take you to the creek and, you know, the river, you know. Stack tells Smoke everything would have been perfect, but he killed Annie. The two fight with Stack trying to bite him, but the mojo bag protects Smoke. He turns the tables and is about to stake Stack. Stake Stack. Smoke says he's sorry he couldn't keep him safe, and Stack says, not to be sorry. He said, you always did. And then that's the last we see of that scene.
Interaction, yeah.
Yeah. Rebek tells of the lies that those men told of God above and the devil below and man's dominion over the beast of earth. He tells Sammy they are earth and beast and God, woman and man. We are connected, you and I, to everything. Then Sammy picks up his guitar and whacks him over the head. And the silver resonator part sticks into Remick's skull as the vampires all scream, which I thought was really cool.
Yes.
I like that Sammy essentially used his religious tool to at least injure the vampire.
Yes.
That's Sammy's religion, is that guitar.
Yeah.
So I like that. But Rebek pulls it out and grabs Sammy by the head, about to bite him, saying they will make beautiful music together. Then Smoke finally impales him with the stake. As the sun starts to rise.
Yes.
All the vampires scream in pain and start to burn as the sun gets higher. They try to run and crawl away, but they all catch fire. But Rebek looks down at the stake and then looks at the sun as he starts to burn. It's like he could have pulled it out maybe, but he's getting to watch the sun rise. So I kind of feel like maybe he just lets it in. What do you think?
I almost wonder if he... came to
people that were marginalized. He finally felt like he was belonged, and then even they won't accept him.
Hmm.
So he's like, what's the point?
Hmm. Maybe. That's true, too. That could be true, too. I just kind of tend to think he was going to pull it out, but he was like, I'm so old and so tired of this.
That's what I'm saying,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, and he's like, I'm getting to see the sunrise. And I mean, you know, I love how incredibly freaked out and trembling Sammy and Smoke are as they're like holding each other, watching him immolate in a fiery tornado. It like swirls around turns into ash in the air. It's really cool. Later, Sammy helps Smoke get the trunk off the truck. Smoke gives Sammy the keys to Stack's car and tells him to go home and bury what's left of his guitar. He says he can. It's Charlie Patton's, and then Smoke tells him that Stack lied, and that's their father's guitar.
Yeah.
Sammy drives to church, and this is where, of course, we came in. Smoke is waiting for the Klan, and he can't roll a cigarette.
Yeah.
He's trembling, but apparently he can't roll it anyway. He flashes back to the scenes of the day and night before we didn't get to see, where everyone is happy, getting ready for the opening. Or
everybody dancing with their particular partner.
Yeah, they're frying the fish and eating it. And I mean, that fried catfish sure looked good.
I know.
I love me some fried catfish. I love good fried catfish. He remembers Annie smiling at him, and he takes off his mojo bag. Then he gets his guns and weapons out.
Yeah.
So, again, the Klan shows up, and what was their plan? Without your theory, was their plan just to kill anyone that's left, particularly the twins, burn the building down, and just say, you can't have this. Now you have no money, and you have no place, and plus we killed however many of you are still here. I mean, would them coming at night and killing everyone in there have been too much even for the Klan back then? Too much heat for them? You know, I don't know.
I don't know.
I just, their plan seems, I know they're idiot, racist a-holes, but their plan seems flawed even for a dumbass.
Yeah.
You know?
But I still think.
I like your theory. I mean, I'm saying, your theory is good, and I actually wish it was in the movie, but I don't think it is, so.
In my mind, it is.
It is. Okay. That's your headcanon. That's fine. But honestly, the most satisfying part of this film is Smoke just annihilating these pieces of shit.
Yeah.
I mean, he starts out with a large machine gun hidden in the brush, then comes out and picks up a Tommy gun he had hid.
Yep.
He throws a hand grenade in on a truck trying to leave, which is cool. And I like that the hand grenade, because not that I'm a military expert, you guys. I just know that my dad was in the Army, and I know a hand grenade doesn't. It's explosive, but it's not like a nuclear bomb. It like makes a small explosion, comparatively.
Yes.
But it does blow it up. It kills the guys inside and catches the truck on fire.
Yeah.
But one of them does get a shot off and hits him in the gut,
mm-hmm.
like over to the side. We keep cutting back to Sammy and his father telling him to put down the guitar, or the neck that's left.
Yeah.
And say that he belongs to the Lord. We go back to the scene with Smoke, and Hogwood is shot up but still alive. And Smoke asks for a cigarette, and Hogwood tells him to go to hell. But then he puts a new clip in his gun, so he gives him one. And Smoke lights it up, and he just falls on his bottom.
Yeah.
And you hear a baby cooing, and he looks over, and Annie is there nursing their daughter. And she tells him if he puts out the cigarette, he can hold her. And Hogwood kind of pulls him out of that for a minute, saying he's got money. And so Smoke just fills him full of holes.
Oh, my gosh. So satisfying.
Yeah. But then you see Annie, and she's got the baby's face covered, like, don't look at this. And you see the gun in the shot, like, it's like they really are there. You know, it's like he's literally, speaking of the veil between life
he's
and...
He's straddling the worlds.
He's straddling the worlds right there. Yeah. Yeah. And of course, he puts a cigarette out. And hands him the baby, and he says, Papa's here, just like he did at the grave.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sammy is holding his guitar in the church. Then he's in his car, or Stack's car, sitting beside him. And then he holds it up to his heart. And then we cut to Chicago, October 16th, 1992, so 60 years later to the day.
Yep.
Sammy, still scarred, is playing on stage. Old Sammy is played by a legendary blues guitarist, Buddy Guy. And I was like, that's Buddy Guy.
Yeah.
I'm like, I think that was Buddy Guy. And then I watched the credit, and it said And Buddy Guy's always like, oh, yeah, it is Buddy Guy. That's great casting. I mean, and the name of the club is Pearlene's.
Yes.
That's a nice touch. So he never forgot her.
Nope.
Yeah. And you may have thought that was the end of the film. And you may have walked out of the theater. Well, we all should know better post-MCU. But this film actually has not only an end credit scene, but the real ending.
Yes.
As a mid-credit scene.
Yes.
Lots of folks have questioned if this was wise, but Coogler did it, so there you go. I mean, you know, I'm kind of surprised they didn't change it, like, on HBO Max and to where it's, like, there's no credit.
Continuous, yeah.
Yeah, to where it doesn't split like that. But we do see, through a few of the credits, we see him playing, like, Buddy Guy as Sammy with the scars on his face.
Yes.
Playing, you know. But then we get the scene with a very 90s Stack and Mary.
Oh, my gosh.
Mary looks like Debbie Mazar.
Yes! She does. Yes! So much so.
She does look like Debbie. She's like 90s Debbie Mazar with her hair pulled back in that, you know, ponytail. The bartender gives Mary a look, but she smiles with her fangs and he bolts. Yeah. Sammy just looks at him and says, how? And Zach says he was the one person Smoke couldn't kill, but he made him promise to leave Sammy alone. And Stack smells Sammy and says it won't be long for him.
Yeah.
I guess vampires probably can smell death. That's a nice wrinkle, you know. He offers to make it so he can stick around and tour and, you know. He wisely says, I think I've seen enough of this place. Zach says they have all his records, but he misses the real pre-electric stuff.
Yeah.
He said, but I like his funny. He's like, those old recordings sound like shit. Because they really do. So Sammy, he asks him to, you know, play a real one for him. He's got one in him. He pulls out a copy of his original guitar.
Yeah.
And plays Traveling for him. Stack lays down the 200 he promised the bouncer to get in and hugs Sammy. And Mary tells little Sammy to take care.
Yeah.
And Sammy says, you know something? Maybe once a week I wake up paralyzed, reliving that night. Before the sun went down, I think that was the best day of my life. Was it like that for you? And Stack replies, no doubt about it. Last time I seen my brother, last time I seen the sun, and just for a few hours, we was free.
Yeah.
So, you know, it just, I don't know, and maybe this is wrong to look at it this way, but I mean, here this guy is getting along with vampires, you know, and we can't, in this society nowadays, we're so split, we can't even get along with our relatives on the internet over politics and shit.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, it just kind of like, these guys tried to kill him, and he's like, yeah. Now, he gives him a hug. Now, you know, yeah. It's just like, time heals all wounds, I guess. I don't know, but it just that popped in my head, you know. It's just like, and I know people got reasons for not, I'm not saying, I'm not judging you for not wanting to have anything to do with people that strongly, you strongly disagree with, especially if they're behind things that hurt people. I'm definitely with you, but it's just, I'm not advocating one way or another. I'm just pointing out that it come to mind.
Yeah.
You know. We get flashes to other happy scenes from that day. Then old Sammy smiles and he thinks back to riding with Smoke and Stack. Then we get the credits. But we also get a post-credit scene with Sammy playing in the church, which isn't really necessary. But, you know, it's you know, it's fine. So what did you think? Did this hold up for you on the second viewing?
Yes.
Did you like it better the second time or the...
I did, because I was more in the, you know, I was like, okay, I could pay attention more to certain things. And I was looking.
You knew the outcome, so you could pay attention to how they were setting it up.
Yes.
More. Yeah. Same with me. I did too. And I mean, I really, we come out of that movie and I was just like, that's like the best movie I've seen in a long time.
Yeah, I know. So
it's like,
I
literally
know.
Like. That's a great movie. I think this movie more than lives up to its hype. It's just a damn good movie on top of being a vampire film. Coogler said he wanted to make a movie about, you know, his family's past and his uncle who loved the blues. It's a snapshot of a period and what people of color went through during that time in the American South. The horror elements are used to magnify and examine the horrors and oppression the people were already suffering.
Yes.
In real life. My dad is a guitarist, and he's more of a Merle Travis, Chet Atkins fingerstyle player than a
damn good one.
Yeah, he is a damn good one. But he's not really a blues guy, but he's that kind of guitarist. And, of course, played bluegrass and everything. But he grew up as a poor farm boy. undoubtedly still better off than the black kids of his era, his contemporaries. But it still made the movie feel a little more real to me. Yeah. You know, because that's like, I can, you know, this is, I mean, my dad's a little bit younger than this, but he was born in 1938. So,
yeah, not by much.
Not by much. So, yeah, I mean, you know, he chose not to follow the musician path. He had opportunities, but, you know, I wouldn't be podcasting right now if he did. So, you know, but yeah, I really hope this film isn't forgotten come Oscar time.
It deserves so many nods. It really does. Yeah,
it came out nearly a year before They'll Be Held, so it might get forgotten. A lot of times those kind of movies are.
Later late in the year, yeah.
Yeah, but it deserves some recognition at the very least. And if you haven't seen it, well, I hope you've seen it before we spoil the hell out of it.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know,
Now that you've seen it, go watch it again.
Yeah, exactly. Go watch it again, then listen to this podcast. That's like, this is one of the few times I'm telling you, don't listen to this podcast. Go watch. I'd rather you watch this movie than listen to this podcast. And then listen to this podcast. Then listen to what two, you know, white people have to say about this movie.
There you go. We are from the South, though.
We are from the South, though. So, yeah. But, no, I love this movie.
Sort of South.
Yeah, sort of South, kind of South. Yeah, but, no, it's a fantastic movie. I'm glad you suggested it. I probably wouldn't have thought to cover it just because it's kind of, you know, it's so new. I think the newest movie before this was Sleepy Hollow, which was already like 25 years old.
Yeah,
almost, you know.
But this is such a good movie.
Yeah, such a fantastic movie. So definitely check it out if you haven't. Okay, we're going to take a quick break for some promos, and then we'll go to the crypt for a vampire comic.
Earth-shattering disasters. Strange sports stories. Five-star superhero spectacular. What do all these titles have in common? Well, they're all Bronze Age DC Comics, of course, but they are all also special. My name is Paul Kien, and I'm the host of the new podcast, DC Specialcast. In the 1970s, DC Comics published a number of catch-all titles, like DC Special, DC Special Series, DC Superstars, and others. These comics varied wildly in content, quality, and even format. Each episode, I will be joined by a guest to explore one of these special comics. So join me for DC Specialcast, coming in 2025, only on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Night has fallen, and the time has come to experience terror at Collinwood, a podcast dedicated to the iconic Gothic television series Dark Shadows. Terror at Collinwood explores the hidden secrets within the sinister walls of the Collins estate. Hosted by two-time Rondo Award-winning television horror hostess Penny Dreadful, the podcast features interviews and in-depth discussions with fans and creators as they examine the cursed characters and supernatural storylines of that creepy classic. Dark Shadows, beware the night and the restless dead who wail on Widow's Hill, and prepare yourself for Terror at Collinwood, a Dark Shadows podcast. Available at terroratcollinwood.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, YouTube, Seance, The I Ching, or wherever you get your scary podcasts.
Okay, we've opened the door to the comic crypt and invited in a vampire comic. Batman Legends of the Dark Knight number 41 was cover dated January 1993, on sale November 24th, 1992, so they missed it by a month.
Yep.
On this cover by Jim Fern, Batman with a huge cape.
Just a little bit.
Seems to be stalking a vampire since he has a wooden stake in his hand. Behind him is the red sky, huge yellow sun, and a winged, demonic, fanged, and clawed figure descending upon him. What do you think of the cover?
Honestly, it is a nice cover. It does not match the interior. To me, I'm thinking aerodynamics and stuff like that. And I'm like, those wings really wouldn't propel this being through the air because they're kind of skinny.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just where my brain went. Sorry.
Yeah, no. And Batman's cape, as we mentioned, is
very voluminous.
It's very voluminous, very humongous. And it kind of looks like this cover tells you Batman versus vampire, but the composition is pretty strange. Batman's huge cape almost looks like mountains.
Yeah.
Not sure why the vampire is flying out in front of the setting sun, other than this title of the story is Sunset.
Right.
And we'll get into that. Sunset, written by Tom Joyner with a plot assist by Keith S. Wilson. with art by Jim Fern, lettered by John Costanza, colored by Steve Olaf, and edited by someone named Kaplan, which I should have looked up, and Archie Goodwin. I'm sure some of you probably know who that is. That was probably Archie's assistant editor, and they were the editors of this story.
As the sun sets in Gotham, Batman, early in his career, evades the police. When his Batmobile blows a tire, he pulls into a strangely open gate of the long-abandoned Gotham Pictures studio. Noticing a figure calling to him, he investigates and is overpowered by a large brutish man dressed in a tuxedo. He brings Batman before his master, who the Dark Knight recognizes as long-dead silent film star Nina DeMille.
DeMille mesmerizes Batman and tells him that she was discovered by a mysterious benefactor who helped make her a star and then, quote-unquote, took her, ensuring her lasting beauty for the past 40 years. She shows Batman the lavish set her butler and director Eric has constructed for her comeback. She feeds on Batman and keeps him as her companion for the next 2 weeks, the masked manhunter's mind still realizing what is happening to him, but unable to resist. She works on her script, they dance, they play cards with wax figures, and watch her cinematic triumphs.
Alfred Pennyworth drives through Gotham searching for any signs of his master and surrogate son. He attempts to stop a couple of thugs shaking down a store owner, but Batman and Nina intervene. Nina feeds on one of the attackers and has Batman stake him so that he won't rise. She lets Alfred go since he's a fan of her films. Alfred returns to the Batcave and prepares for battle with wooden stakes and crucifix. The amateur sleuth correctly deduces Nina would be holed up at the old Gotham Pictures lot. There, he stakes Eric, and when an angry Nina attacks him, Batman snaps out of her control. Alfred hits the stage lights, and the deluded Nina believes herself to be on set, filming her comeback. Batman opens the sunroof as the dawn pours in, reducing her to ash and bone.
So, the title of this story is no coincidence, because this is a not at all disguised version of the famous Billy Wilder film Sunset Boulevard, with Batman and vampires. In that film, a B-movie screenwriter is on the run from creditors and hides at the estate of a washed-up silent screen star, deluded into thinking the world is waiting for a comeback. Sound familiar?
Just a minute.
I think this is so close, there honestly should be a credit to writer Charles Brackett and to Billy Wilder. No. I mean, there's homages, and then there's just...
Lifting it out.
We took your story and just redid it this way, you know. I mean, I don't think they were trying to hide it, but at the same time, I think there should have been at least an acknowledgement to the people that created that movie. But interestingly enough, this is not only an homage I use lightly, to that film, it's kind of a pilot for another comic series. Scarlet, with two T's at the end, was a DC horror action title launched the following month by the same creative team. It ran 14 issues with Fern as the artist on the first 12. There is little to no info on this series out there on the internet, believe it or not. It seems to have vanished down the memory hole. If any listeners read it, let us know about it in the comments.
Yes.
I remember when it was out, and I kind of remember, oh, did this tie into that? But that's about all I know about it. Tom Joyner actually debuted in one of those DC bonus books in the 80s. Which gave new talent a showcase in a main DC title. He wrote for several titles and co-created Damage, but seems to have dropped out of comics by 1996. Keith S. Wilson was primarily an inker, but he had writing credits with Joyner on the Hammerlock series at DC and, of course, like we said, Scarlet. He seems to have disappeared from comics in the mid-90s as well.
Okay.
So maybe these two guys became vampires and are going to do their comeback.
Oh, okay.
I really hope that something awful didn't happen to him. Now I'm going to feel really bad if it did. Jim Fern got his start in DC's previous tryout project, the series New Talent Showcase. Other than Scarlet and a decent run on Legion, that's the acronym Legion, like Legion 89, 90, you know, in the Vertigo series Crossing Midnight, he was essentially a journeyman artist. He had drawn Batman Annual number 15 in 1991 as part of the Armageddon 2001 storyline, and he drew Batman with huge ears in that one, and they're a little tiny because they're year one Batman.
Oh, gotcha.
In this one. In this story, Batman is lamenting he went out too early, the cops are after him, and his mystique just doesn't work in the day, drawing parallels to vampires, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
Very, very obviously. I think the Batmobile in this story is the same one that Paul Galassi designed as the first Batmobile in the Legend of the Dark Knight Prey storyline by him and Doug Minch.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think so. These don't necessarily have to follow that strict of a continuity, but it looks like they did in that regard anyway.
Okay.
When Batman swings into the studio, there's a bat in the panel, but it's not mentioned. Is that Nina?
I wondered about that, you know, but yeah, I wasn't sure.
Because it's a big, giant bat that he swings past, but there's no mention of it. And Nina DeMille is a bit on the nose, don't you think?
I was just like, wait a minute. As soon as they said the name, I'm like, what?
Cecil B. DeMille was the most famous director of the Golden Age of Hollywood. I mean, from Silence up through, you know, the Ten Commandments. So, I mean, yeah. she does look truly mesmerizing on that huge splash, though, with her big giant eyes. But she kind of also looks like Cruella de Vil.
I'm trying to understand, you know, when you have her talking about when she was taken and everything, it makes it sound like she was young. But in several of these, like this particular, I mean, she looks old as hell.
Yeah. I mean, they keep, like, going back and forth between. Sometimes she's got black hair, sometimes she's got gray hair, and sometimes she looks pretty youthful. Her body looks youthful, but her face looks older.
Yes. I mean, and there's that one where she's writing when she's sitting at the desk with her little sweater and stuff like that. I'm like, what is this? Murder, She Wrote? Is she, you know...
Jessica Fletcher?
Fletcher, yeah. Yeah. I'm like, what?
So the vampire, you mentioned that. So the vampire that took her, she says, you would know his name if I told you. Is that supposed to be Dracula or maybe a famous Hollywood type that they're implying was a vampire?
Maybe it's Christopher Lee.
Or Bela Lugosi.
Yeah,
it'd be more Bela Lugosi, I think, than Christopher Lee. Or maybe it's Max Schreck from Nosferatu.
Oh, there you go.
Not Christopher Walken Max Schreck. The real Max Schreck. Yeah, yeah. She's planning her comeback, and we established the sunroof, which was used to cut down on lighting costs. Makes sense.
They're setting that up, and you're like, oh, yeah, that's going to come. I mean, as soon as I saw that, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's coming back later.
There's Chekhov's sunroof. It's going to go off later, yeah. She looks pretty nasty when she goes to bite him, too.
Uh-huh.
I mean, she's pretty creepy looking. She tells Eric not to remove his mask. She wants him as he should be. So we get to see Batman in his cowl, but also in a tuxedo dancing with her and watching movies and just watching her type, as you said, when she's in her old granny mode. And she's probably typing this horrible script. So what do you think about all this?
I'm just like, really? And then he's in the gladiator outfit.
Yeah, later he's in the gladiator outfit, yeah.
And I'm like, oh.
And they're going to kill both these characters anyway, so why didn't she just unmask him?
Exactly.
So it wouldn't have looked quite as goofy if Bruce Wayne had been, obviously Bruce Wayne in a tuxedo. We're used to that, you know. So, it was kind of strange. I think the wax figure, I haven't seen Sunset Boulevard in years, but I think the wax figure thing, them playing cards with wax figures, is from that movie too.
Oh, okay.
I think it's got something to do with that too. Yeah, I probably should have rewatched the movie before we did this, but you know,
there's only so much time in the day.
Yeah, there's only so much time in the day, and I wanted to put that time into talking about Sinners, not this. So,
yes.
Yeah. So, do you think she took advantage of him in other ways?
I don't know. I kind of wondered about that too, but depending on what she saw as the mores of that time, would she have done that?
Well, and also
the mores of, you know, the silent film era.
Right. Well, I mean, the mores of that time weren't what they advertised.
But, yeah, I know.
But I think, you know, a lot of times the vampire bite is the sexual act.
Yeah.
And there's not actual, you know, human sex.
Intercourse. Yeah.
Intercourse, yeah. So maybe that's all it was, but who knows. We cut to Alfred searching for Bruce, and he sees Batman's silhouette on a rooftop with someone else.
Mm-hmm.
He quips about the insurance industry as he breaks up the extortion shakedown. That's pretty
funny.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. But what is Nina wearing? Was she auditioning for a superhero role?
I like the outfit. That's pretty cool.
You like that outfit?
Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, it does look cool. She's got like a purple bodysuit with a boob window and a diamond shape cut out around her navel.
Yes, and then she's got the little short red cape. I mean, I like the outfit.
Yeah, it's a cool look, like a vampire, female vampire superhero or something. Yeah. It kind of works, but yeah, then they show that one panel of her, like she almost looks like a werewolf.
Yeah.
Like when she's like coming up from feeding, and then Batman stakes the guy she bit. Alfred protests, but Nina tells him to back off, and then he recognizes her and says he's enjoyed her film with Douglas Fairbanks, and since he's a fan, she lets him go.
But what gets me is, does that mean every time she goes out to feed, does she have to stake the person she feeds on?
If she didn't want them rising as vampires.
And then how is that not, you know, there's all these staked bodies going through the city, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, or how often does she feed? I'm like, wait a minute, let's talk about this.
Yeah, maybe she's normally just, like, feeding on homeless people or something and they don't, but, you know, and
still,
disposing of the body somewhere. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Alfred makes stakes and takes a crucifix from what seems to be Wayne Manor, and there are portraits of Jesus near it. I never thought of Bruce Wayne being overly religious.
I know.
Or his parents, honestly.
No.
So it's kind of, that's interesting that they have that. Maybe it's like from an older part of the manor that like his grandparents or
something. Yeah.
Something. I don't know. Alfred is dressed in classic Sherlock Holmes attire, plaid deerstalker hat and Inverness cloak, you know, he's straight up, which Alfred in the Golden Age wore the deerstalker cap and had the pipe when he was the amateur sleuth. You know, they did stories like that, so that was a callback to that. Nina's dressed as Cleopatra, and as you said, Batman, a Roman soldier, a gladiator, which is pretty kinky.
Well, I mean, you know, Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor.
Right, exactly, yeah. Alfred stakes Eric pretty quickly, and Nina gets real ugly really quick.
Oh, yeah.
While she swats the crucifix from his hand, she rambles on about how big a star she was.
Well, of course she does.
Yeah. This snaps Batman out of it. They fight, and Alfred hits the lights, and she thinks she's on stage. She asks what the scene is, and Batman tells her it's the premiere of Song of Solomon, which was the movie.
And apparently it was going to be like, you know, 12 hours long or something, because she just kept filming it, you know.
Yeah, kept adding to it and everything, yeah. She gives a speech about how she wasn't forgotten, and Batman hits the controls of the sunroof, which opens up as she catches fire. She's still saying she was the biggest star of them all. So, I mean, she's immolating.
Yes.
And she's still going on about how big of a star she was. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty crazy. And
and she didn't have a consistent monster look or transformed look. That's something that bothered me because, you know, you have where she looks kind of serpentine in this one. And then before she looked werewolfish and then bat-like. So I'm like, well, it's not real consistent here.
Yeah, I mean, she's got the snake thing on her head because she's Cleopatra. And she looks pretty snake-like.
Yeah.
I mean, her skin's even darkened. Her skin color kept changing throughout this, too.
Yes.
Which I thought was kind of weird. Alfred's monologue at the end is a little much. He says Nina never realized what she had become, but Bruce fully understands what he's become. He's not some murderous undead monster, Alfred.
Exactly.
I mean, I know you don't exactly approve of what he does in some ways, even though you enable it, but at the same time, it's like, he's not, like, killing people and making them the undead and, you know, just like...
But I do like, you know, that in part of that, when he's going out to find him to go help him, he actually says, you know, who thinks that this would be above, you know, my duties and my obligations, but who am I kidding? You basically know that Alfred sees Bruce as his son. He says it without saying it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is a good part for Alfred. I mean, he saves the day.
Yeah.
That's for sure. If it hadn't been for Alfred, Batman, there'd been a horrible movie made, and Batman'd probably be a vampire. So.
Yeah.
So what did you think of this one?
Like I told you this morning after I read it, it's perfunctory. I'm just kind of like, okay.
Yeah, I will admit, I forgot it was so blatantly an homage / ripoff of Sunset Boulevard. I know it's completely intentional. They weren't trying to hide it. I still think they probably should have given some kind of credit. I think it's kind of a fun idea, but the execution is just a little off. I think trying to set this in the serious Batman year one milieu of this series was kind of a mistake. You know, it's like every other storyline in this comic has been pretty gritty. You know, I mean, there were a few that were more science fiction-y and stuff, but generally in this era, they were sticking to kind of like the Frank Miller, Dave Mazzucchelli year one kind of vibe. So you take that Batman and you drop him into this kind of silly, and not, I mean, a regular vampire story, like, you know, a retelling of The Monk or something would be fine. But this whole Sunset Boulevard remake is kind of weird. But I don't really like how tiny Batman's head is in some panels, but Fern's vampire stuff is truly frightening. It's well done.
It is well done, but not consistent. I'm sorry.
No, it's not. It's not consistent. But all in all...
But then again, I think about, you know, with Francis Ford Coppola, you know, he changed into a bat creature. He changed into rats. So there's that.
And that was, you know, this came out after that, right? Because that was 92, and this is, what, 90? No, this is right around the same time. This is... Like, literally around the same time that Bram Stoker's Dracula came out. But, you know, we'd had other vampires around this time that took on more horrific forms, like Fright Night and Lost Boys. So that was kind of the trend. You know, it's like, they're not just, you know, they don't just have fangs and their eyes go red. They turn into these monstrous, you know, werebat creatures and things like that, you know. So, yeah. All in all, I don't mean to be too harsh on this, but It's worth a read, but I don't know if it's
not going to be a perennial thing to read.
No, I think there's a reason why this doesn't usually come up. We've done so many vampire comics that I'm like, oh, well, we haven't done that one yet, and I didn't bother to reread it. So, I mean, again, it's worth your time to reread. It's out on the DC Universe Infinite app if you have that. It's worth a read, or especially around Halloween. Just keep in mind that it's kind of cheeky with because of the Sunset Boulevard thing. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's kind of like the art and the story are kind of fighting each other because the story's kind of goofy and the art's kind of horrific.
Yeah.
So it's kind of strange. I think this season our clear winner was Amazing Spider-Man number 6.
Oh, yeah.
Not surprisingly.
Oh, no.
It's a classic for a reason, so. Well, that will wrap up the House of Frankenstein for this season. A huge shout out, as always, to our friend Terry O'Malley, a.k.a. Ward Hill Terry, or Ward Hills Have Eyes Terry, for the House of Frankenstein theme. You can follow Terry's band, Stop Calling Me Frank, on their Facebook page. Check the show notes for more info.
Special thanks to our Patreon supporters. For information on how you can support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, visit patreon.com/FWPodcast.
Thank you to everyone for listening. Be sure to let us know your thoughts on this movie and the comic over on the show thread at FireAndWaterPodcast.com. Also, if you ever read the comic Scarlet, if you ever saw Sunset Boulevard, read this comic and went like, hey, wait a minute. And especially what you thought of Sinners. That's more important. But,
well, yeah.
I do try to respond to everyone personally. I have been doing that. We don't do feedback on air here, but I do because, you know, we take... You know, we do 4 episodes in a batch and then take off for a year, so we don't get to do that. But I definitely respond to everybody, so definitely check that out. And let us know your thoughts on this. And if any of the other movies, if you didn't get around to doing that, that'd be fine. Cindy and I will return to wrap up JLU Cast, hopefully by the end of this year. But we have a lot going on with jobs and kids and grandkids and things like that, so please be patient.
Just celebrated her first birthday. She's adorable.
Yes.
Sorry, I can't help it. I like to gush about her.
Yes.
And Danny's finishing up her senior year of high school and going off to college, and Andrew's plugging away, and so, you know.
And I have a newish job that's at the same place but in a different location.
You got transferred.
Yeah, basically, yeah. So that's changed things up. So, life happens. So we'll try to get back to it before the end of the year, but we will eventually, before too long, wrap things up at JLU Cast. After that, we plan on doing occasional episodes of Mr. and Mrs. Superman over on the Justice Society Presents feed. And you can catch me monthly on Batman Nightcast with Ryan Daly, where we talk about, you know, no offense, better Batman comics, and quarterly with Siskoid on the Brave and the Bold episodes of FW Team Up. So check those out.
We hope you have a safe and entertaining spooky Halloween.
See you next year.
Bye.
Supermates is a Franklin and Franken production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises Worldwide and is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. The characters and properties mentioned in this show are copyright their respective holders. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their holders and no infringement is implied. So please don't sue my mommy and daddy. Emails can be sent to supermatespodcast@gmail.com.
Comments can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook by searching for Supermates and FW Podcast Network.
Please consider leaving a review on iTunes. Thank you for listening to Supermates, the husband and wife geek cast.
Forgive me and let me see the dawning. Not so far away from my life. I've been waiting for a day like today. So I live like it's the last time for a long time at the wrong time.